Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Lexington, Massachusetts.
And when did you first realize you had an interest in mathematics?
Well, I remember, so we actually moved to Lexington when I was five,
mm-hmm.
but one of my earliest memories is when I was four, I suppose. I was less than five in any case, because I was living in Arlington.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really interested in spirographs. Do you know what that is?
Oh, yeah.
With the pen and the cycles.
Yes.
And I really was interested in this idea of periods. I mean, I didn't know what they were called, but I remember noticing that certain sizes of the spirograph, if I fixed the external circle, would have give me a period of two, others would give me a period of three, or I should say maybe three and four, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that there was a relationship between the one that had six and the one that had three. I also remember in that same apartment, really caring about the idea of that you could divide certain numbers by two and you couldn't divide other numbers by two evenly. Of course, I didn't know what about halves, so it bothered me that there were odd numbers. I wasn't formally interested in math for a while, although my parents were both mathematicians. My mother was an applied mathematician. She got her PhD at Harvard in applied math in the early 70s. My father got his PhD with Jean-Paul Rota in combinatorics also in the early 70s. Or late 60s, and my father also wrote a paper with Erdős, so he had an Erdős number of one, and I remembered him asking me some questions that Erdős had told him to ask young budding mathematicians.
Mm-hmm.
I remember what the question was, because I was 11, and the question was this. It was, if you have two n numbers, and you choose n plus one of them, then prove that two of them have to be relatively prime to each other. And I, you know, certainly knew by then what relatively prime meant. I was fascinated by primes. I often would factor license plates. That's what I did in the school bus all by myself because I was a huge nerd. It was basically a pigeonhole problem. I noticed that if you had n plus one of them, then two of them had to be adjacent and their difference was one, and then they'd have to be relatively prime. But I got, you know, I sort of really liked the question and I really liked my solution, and you know, I was very proud of it. Then I didn't think much more about math for a while, and I wanted to become a musician, actually. I was very interested in piano, and I was, you know, pretty talented. And I was excited to become a musician. My parents weren't as excited about it. But when I was, I think, 1987, so I was turning, you know, 15 that summer, and I was all set to go to Switzerland to music camp where I would be practicing 5 hours a day with the people who really wanted to become musicians. My parents weren't very excited about it, and, like, in fact, they tried to discourage me. They said, if you want to go to this, you'll have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured out a way to, like, work jobs, and
mm-hmm.
I negotiated lowering the tuition by agreeing to babysit the person's, my piano teacher's camp, like, to babysitting her daughter. And I was going to make it. I was going to have enough money to go to this. And what happened was, it was near the end of the school year. I was all set to go to Switzerland. I hadn't bought the ticket yet. And I went to a math competition because I was on the math team. But I was kind of, you know, it wasn't that I was reluctantly on the math team, but I wasn't really hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
I was on the math team because I was such a nerd, you know, that kind of thing. And I did really well in the math competition. It was a statewide meet. And at that statewide meet, I met somebody named David Kelly, who gave me a brochure for his math camp, Hampshire College Summer Studies in Math. And I came home with this brochure, which was weird and interesting and totally not musical. And I showed it to my parents, and they were so excited. And they said, you know, if you want to go to this math camp, we will pay for it and give you $50 a week for spending money. And of course, by that time, I was obsessed with money. And I said, I can't turn down that offer. So I ended up going to math camp instead of music camp. And, it, you know, like, looking back, it was a huge bribe, but at the same time, my parents saw in me, like, a seriousness of purpose, which I really did have. I decided to become a mathematician that summer, and if I'd gone to music camp, I have no doubt that I would have become a musician.
What high school did you go to?
Lexington High School.
Oh, okay.
My parents believed in the school system in Lexington. Right. That's why they scrimped and saved to get there.
Mm-hmm.
For me and my brother.
And the school did well enough for you in math, or were there other opportunities?
Yeah, I mean, the school was pretty good, mostly because of the other kids.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had a few good teachers. I had quite a few bad teachers. I finished the math part, the math curriculum,
mm-hmm.
there in sophomore year.
Mm-hmm.
But what was cool is that, of course, by that time I had a car, I was driving. I had a
mm-hmm.
crappy little car. We called it an O'Neill Mobile.
Mm-hmm.
And I started going to Harvard and MIT for classes. And I took a probability class from my father's advisor, Jean-Claude Rocha, when I was a senior.
Mm-hmm. That'd be at MIT.
At MIT,
right.
Yes. And I took a bunch of Harvard extension classes in math.
So what brought you to Berkeley?
Well, let's see. I was a free spirit. You know, I was a hippie, basically,
mm-hmm.
even though it was way past that time.
Yes.
But Hampshire College kind of made me believe that it was possible.
Mm-hmm.
I went back to math camp the next summer, by the way. I was really in love with that culture of non-competitive, you know, love of mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
It was not one of those places where you were scored or ranked. It was a place
mm-hmm.
where you came if you loved mathematics, and
mm-hmm.
I did. I wanted to go somewhere that was mathematically strong and that I could be not uptight, you know. MIT and Harvard were too uptight for my attitude at the time, and I also wanted to go with my best friends from high school, so we all went together to UC Berkeley. It was wonderful. It was a great place to be, and I was excited to take Hungarian. It was one of the only places in the country that taught Hungarian as a language. I'd already decided to go to the Hungarian math, the math program. Because I was interested in combinatorics. You learn a little bit of combinatorics when you go to math camp, you know, and it's so accessible. It's really,
mm-hmm.
really appealing. So I wanted to do that. And I ended up doing it. I studied Hungarian for 2 years, and then my junior year I went to Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
Although, when I got there, I realized it wasn't really for me. And that was probably my most existential angsty moment of being
mm-hmm.
a young math person, was I was like, I don't really like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like, I don't really know why I'm doing this.
Mm-hmm.
It was like the first time I felt like, I need motivation. I need
mm-hmm.
to know what the point of this is mathematically. Yes, it's an interesting question, but why do we care about the answer? And just at that moment, a friend of mine from Berkeley, who was feeling my pain, sent me a book, written by John Tate and Silverman, about elliptic curves, rational
mm-hmm.
points on elliptic curves. And it seemed to me the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. And I still think so, actually. It's just about taste, right? It comes
mm-hmm.
down to taste.
Mm-hmm.
And what I realized was, I'm a number theorist.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the geometry part of
mm-hmm.
number theory. So it was just this wonderful connection between
mm-hmm.
Spatial geometry, which I'd always loved, and also, you know, this discreteness
mm-hmm.
of combinatorics, which I'd loved, but some kind of depth as well, this feeling of like you're creating a theory and you
mm-hmm.
have these deep questions and you want to answer them, which of course
mm-hmm.
exist in all sorts of fields once you get involved
mm-hmm.
enough, but this is what attracted me.
So when you're talking about motivation, it isn't necessarily about application.
No, it's not, although that's what I do now.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I just needed to care about the question more.
Mm-hmm.
And I did care about questions when it comes to Diophantine equations. That's what I mean by taste. Like,
right.
Everybody cares about different things for different reasons.
Right.
I happen to care about the question of, are there rational points on these kinds of curves? And or I eventually started caring very deeply about whether the Tate-Chaffee-Ravitch group of an elliptic curve is finite.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an arithmetic question.
Mm-hmm.
So I came back to Berkeley, and I dedicated myself to learning number theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky, very lucky, to be there with Hendrik Lundstrom and Ken Ribbitt.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of dove in headfirst into p-adic numbers and algebraic
mm-hmm.
number theory. And algebra, I met Serge Lang there, who was a good friend.
Mm-hmm.
I was very lucky to be there at that time and to have such great mentoring.
Mm-hmm.
I also met my thesis advisor, Barry Mazur, when he was visiting Berkeley
mm-hmm.
in those years. And I decided to be his student
mm-hmm.
way before it was at all reasonable to think
mm-hmm.
I could do that. But I eventually got into Harvard and went there, and I was very happy to work with Barry.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you went to Harvard, that has not been the most welcoming place for women over the years.
Yeah.
And from what I hear, it still continues to be not the best place. Did you find those kinds of pressures on top of the studies, or could you focus on your studies?
I actually found it to be relatively welcoming to
mm-hmm.
me. And part of that was, in my year, there happened to be a lot of women.
Ah.
I was in a year of three women out of 10, and also a couple women came who had been deferring the previous year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also there was a woman visiting from, I think, the NSA,
mm-hmm.
And her name's Barb, and we all of us women, for whatever reason,
mm-hmm.
ended up taking algebraic geometry together with a woman.
Oh.
So it was like a little woman core.
Mm-hmm.
In my year,
mm-hmm.
and it was very nice.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed it. I spent 1 year in Princeton
mm-hmm.
after I got engaged to my husband, who was a Princeton professor, and I didn't like that. And there, it was much more male-dominated.
Mm-hmm.
And it was much more male, I would say. So I came back to Harvard really appreciating how welcoming
mm-hmm.
it was.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is the number of women, but it's also a it's also a feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a very tough environment, women don't want to come.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to say just because of the number of women. It's like,
mm-hmm.
I now, after that experience, think of, if you look into a place and see no women, that's a sign that the place has a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that they need more women. It's that the culture itself might be
mm-hmm.
suspect.
What was your thesis on?
It was on realizing models of genus one curves that we knew had to exist. There exists something. Well, what is it? Give me a picture of it. Give me some a formula. So it was towards part of it was like the idea of creating families of Tate-Chaffee-Ravitch elements for an elliptic curve. So you could specialize these. I wrote families of genus one curves, but you could specialize them in some cases to be Tate-Chaffee-Ravitch
mm-hmm.
elements, which is to say they were curves that looked like they had rational points from the perspective of every prime,
mm-hmm.
but didn't actually have any rational points. So they were a conundrum
mm-hmm.
if you think of primes as powerful when they get together in groups.
Mm-hmm.
When they have unanimous decision, primes
mm-hmm.
often are right, and that's the local global principle. And it's true for quadratic equations, for example, but it's not true as soon as you look at genus one curves, and the Tate-Chaffee-Ravitch group elements are counterexamples to it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was directly the kind of thing I wanted to do, and I liked the idea of starting with something existential and turning it into something concrete.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I worked on. And I really loved what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I was a postdoc at MIT after I finished at Harvard, and I had two kids, and I'll tell you what, it's hard to be a postdoc and have kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to continue doing research. I found it really difficult. And it's a pretty unforgiving environment,
mm-hmm.
in not just MIT, I mean, I think they did their best there. It's mathematics as a general rule. I mean, academics for that matter. This idea that you are on a clock that's ticking once
mm-hmm.
you get your PhD is really rough for people who want children. Even so, when I got a really great job at Barnard College and
mm-hmm.
I went there, I didn't feel, ultimately, I didn't feel like I wasn't going to get tenure.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy to be able to say that. I felt
mm-hmm.
comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But at that moment, what happened with me is I realized that it wasn't actually a suitable job for me. After having thought, since I was, 14, 15, here's what I want to do with my life, I got there and I was like, I looked around and I said, you know what? I like feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And not just for my students. Of course, I love feedback for my students. I love teaching.
Mm-hmm.
But I like impact. I like thinking that what I'm thinking about my ideas are having an impact on the world. I like knowing that someone cares about the answer to the questions I'm trying to answer. And that's just not exactly how you feel when you're a number theorist. You feel like it's a privilege to be
mm-hmm.
answering and asking the questions that you think are the most beautiful in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I still think they're the most beautiful things in the world. But they're not necessarily urgent
mm-hmm.
Or important. I mean, they might be important in a sort of like global sense of human understanding. But they're not like, nobody's waiting for the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And even more than that, like if you answer it and try to publish it 7 years later, sometimes it comes out. So
mm-hmm.
it was like a very slow feedback loop. And I just, at some point, once I got to New York and saw the energy of New York City,
mm-hmm.
just realized that I liked feedback and I was kind of an impatient person. So I looked around. There was also a couple other issues, one of them being that my organizational abilities were being exploited rather than rewarded in academics. And I've always been a sort of fix-it, if there's a problem type person.
Mm-hmm.
That can get you in a lot of trouble in a department where you're the only untenured person.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of just, I looked around and I said, you know what, I think I want to be a business person. I think I want my ideas to have impact in the real world. And I looked around, I got sort of the only job I knew how to get,
mm-hmm.
which was to be a quant at a hedge fund.
Mm-hmm. At a pretty exciting time for those.
Yes, in 2006 is when
mm-hmm.
I got the offer, and I didn't start till the beginning of June 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So I entered at the very height
yeah.
of the market, and everybody was like completely sure of themselves and sure that they had some kind of magic sauce and completely unafraid
mm-hmm.
of trusting that things would continue as they always had in their memory of whatever, how many months they had been there.
Mm-hmm.
Some cases more than a few months.
Yeah.
I remember, because I'm someone who relies on axioms and
mm-hmm.
wants to question every assumption.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, that somehow, in some sense, held me back as a number theorist, but also, made me really know what I was talking about for the most part,
mm-hmm.
at any given moment.
Mm-hmm.
I remember just asking the stupidest questions when I first got to D.E.
Mm-hmm.
Shaw. I would be asking, like, well, what if, I would read this book about the market, and I'd say,
mm-hmm.
well, what if liquidity dries up?
Mm-hmm.
And people would be like, that's a stupid question. Liquidity will never dry up. That kind
right.
of thing. There were a lot of conversations like
mm-hmm.
that, which I wish I had recorded.
Yes. Yeah.
Anyway, I was there for a couple months, and then, all hell broke loose, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And especially within the Shaw, like within finance.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the country and the world didn't really see what was happening until this next summer in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
But as early as August 2007, it was obvious inside that there was a major issue,
mm-hmm.
and the issue was credit,
mm-hmm.
that people were stopping, when I say people, I should say not people, the banks were refusing to lend to each other,
mm-hmm.
or they were asking for higher and higher collateral, or better and better, shorter and shorter maturities.
After they had to create the problem.
Of course. So it was a really interesting time. It wasn't a great time to enter finance if you wanted to get rich, but I actually never really cared about money. I needed money to live. Mm-hmm. I had two children at the time. And in fact, I had another child while I was there. So money was important, of course, but it wasn't ever my goal.
Mm-hmm.
And that set me aside, that set me apart from everyone else there. And it really helped me sort of be a witness in a sort of
mm-hmm.
sociological way.
Mm-hmm.
It was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's a place to be. I worked with Larry Summers, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I got to see these guys who were experts, you know, really up close, and listen to them talk about what was going on in the world when Lehman fell and
mm-hmm.
Lehman owned 20% of D.E. Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really, really exciting time. And like going back, and there were lots of things that were really tough about it. I'm not going to say it was great, but it was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gotten more than I'd asked for in terms of living in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hadn't gotten more than I asked for in terms of feedback, because what I hadn't realized leaving academics and going into being a proprietary trading quant, like, you don't get to talk to anyone about what you're doing. And that, not even other people at your company, which
mm-hmm.
is strange, you know, I didn't expect
yeah.
that. So, yeah, I mean, that was not great.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, wait a second, you know, I want people to care about what I'm doing, and nobody even knows what I'm doing because I'm not allowed to talk to anyone. You
mm-hmm.
know, so it was a weird thing. I ultimately left there, and I, you know, because the same sort of urge that made me kind of overly organized and potentially exploitable
mm-hmm.
in academics made me want, once I'd been in finance for a couple of years, to help fix the problem
mm-hmm.
in finance. I was like, oh, this isn't about me, this is about the system, and the system needs to get better. So I applied to get a job as a quant at like all the regulators, and nobody wanted me, which was interesting and political. I started understanding a little bit more about politics and the intersection of economics and mathematical modeling and politics. And I got a job at a risk company, and I looked at the mathematical model behind risk all over the financial system. And in particular, I focused on credit default swaps, which were kind of the part of the toxic instrument suite that took down AIG. They took down AIG for real. AIG wrote these insurance
mm-hmm.
policies, essentially, on bonds, and never set aside any money to cover losses. And once things got really unstable, the people that owned these insurance policies, like Goldman Sachs in particular, demanded collateral.
Mm-hmm.
And AIG just didn't have anything like that kind of money set aside for
mm-hmm.
collateral. And the government had to step in and bail out AIG. And that was outrageous. That was outrageous. I knew that was outrageous. Basically, at that time, I thought a mathematical improvement might help.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and I was like, we're going to understand risk, we understand credit default swaps.
Mm-hmm.
And I did actually learn a lot about why the current value at risk model failed
mm-hmm.
For credit default swaps. And, you know, in a word, like the tails are so, so fat
mm-hmm.
that the normal distribution, which is assumed, and the short time window, which is assumed
mm-hmm.
in risk modeling, is totally insufficient for credit default
mm-hmm.
swaps. Not to mention the independence that is assumed.
Mm-hmm.
So I did work on that mathematical model, but what else happened was I was, for the first time in my life, my job was customer service.
Mm-hmm.
I left the risk group and I went into customer. I was basically working as an account manager, which for the most quantitative hedge funds, but I was also answering the hotline. And by the way, you know, it's kind of fun to be, you know, somebody who wasn't PhD mathematician,
mm-hmm.
you know, PhD mathematician, professor, and then you're answering a customer
mm-hmm.
service line, and you know you're in a different job.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I realized was at the time that the 2 week to fail banks just didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't care about their model. And I realized that I can't solve this problem with math.
Mm-hmm.
this is not a mathematical problem. This is a politics problem. This is a problem of will. If they don't think that they're going to get in trouble for blowing up the world, the financial system, then they're not going to stop. Doesn't matter how much, how well a risk model can make predictions. So that's when I decided, screw this, I'm leaving finance altogether, and I left, and I started my blog, partly out of disgust from what I had seen, and because I wanted to flip this idea that, you know, these techniques should be used for, you know, exploiting the financial system. I thought the mathematical techniques I'd learned were very powerful and should be used to help the world rather than to exploit opportunities. And so that was my idealistic vision of starting Math Babe. And I soon realized that what I loved about Math Babe was the feedback. You know, going back to my addiction to feedback. I really enjoyed, one of my first blog posts ever was about how I don't like math competitions. And I think it was called Math Contests Kind of Suck. And I just loved the number, and I was teaching at math camp, by the way. I've been going back to this math camp a bunch of times. I was teaching at math camp. I'll never forget the explosion in the conversation around this post. And I'm a person who never read blogs. I started a blog not having read one blog, and I still don't read blogs. I never ask anyone to read my blog. It's just, why would anybody read my blog? I have no idea. But what I can tell you is it's a lot of fun to write. I get exactly what I've always wanted, which is immediate feedback. And it's so much fun because it's so iterative learning. You know, it's so focused on, like, here's an idea, what do you guys think? And then all sorts of people write back thoughtful, argumentative responses, which I incorporate or reject or love. And then I get to move on, you know? And, of course, it was also the first time I'd ever considered myself a writer in any capacity. I'd never thought of myself as a writer. But, yeah, it's been really fantastic. And at the same time, I needed a job. I'd left finance. I was grossed out by finance. So I ended up looking in LinkedIn and figuring out, like, look, I'm still a mathematician. I still have these I have more quantitative skills now. What can I do with this in New York City? Because I don't want to leave the city. And I found out there was this job called data scientist. And I was like, oh, I could do that. So I started working as a data scientist in New York. And that was a lot of fun. And that... and has been a lot of fun, in large part because it's not proprietary like finance was. I can't say exactly what I'm doing to somebody, but I can talk about the kind of thing I'm doing. So it's a much more open, it's not as open as academics, but even academics is sometimes not that open, depending on whether people think people are going to scoop them or something. But it's a lot closer than it was in finance, and it's very high impact, very good feedback. So it's a really good job for me. And I recently came out with a book. I'm coming out with a book this week, actually, or next week, with the publisher O'Reilly, called Doing Data Science. And that's based with Rachel Schutt, based on a class that Rachel taught a year ago at Columbia. I helped her organize it, and it basically brought in a bunch of data scientists to Columbia to explain what they do and how they use mathematical algorithms to do it. And it was super fascinating to be at those lectures and to blog them, and then to turn those blog posts into chapters. And my talk tonight is based on a couple of those chapters.
Because one of my questions was how the topic of your talk arose. What context did that come?
Yeah, so one of the people who visited and spoke in that class is Matt Gaddis, and he is the CTO and founder of Hitch. I think it's called Hitch. Let me think about this. There's so many like one word. I want to say, is it Hunch? Maybe it's Hunch. I'll figure it out. One of those. It was acquired by eBay recently, and the idea is you go and you answer a bunch of questions that they ask, like 20 questions, and then they know you. And then they, you know, you could ask them a question, like, you know, what kind of laptop should I buy? And they're like, oh, you're the kind of person that's going to like this laptop. And it's really fun. And the way he explained how they do their algorithm, and he even gave us source code, a mini baby version of it, which is in our book. And it's just so cool. And I got really into it. And then, you know, because by the way, like, in finance, you don't do stuff like that. I mean, I'm not saying there's nobody in finance doing recommendation engines, but in finance, you have not that much data, believe it or not, even though there's, it seems like there's a lot of data in finance. It's, everybody knows what the data is, and the signal's low, and it's very noisy data, and you're eking out this models on very little signal. And and so usually the best you can do is a linear approximation. It's like just a regression. A very fancy regression with a very careful prior, but it's a regression. Whereas in the world of people, and especially if they're answering questions that you're asking them, your signal is just incredibly high, and you have a sort of wealth of data. And so these recommendation engines are working with very different kind of data. And you also don't lose the, there's no feedback loop like there is in finance. In finance, if you have signal in your data and you make money off of it, then your signal goes away. Whereas that's not true. If you have signal in your data for recommendations and you're and you do a good job recommending things, then people are more willing to answer your questions, not less. So you, your signal gets stronger. So it's a positive feedback loop in that sense. And it makes it a really different kind of approach. And so that's one of my, it's just been fun for me to like learn a bunch of different ways of doing it.
You've covered a wide range of things already. I think, to finish off, where do you see yourself, say, 5 years from now? I could ask 10 years, but it depends on what your frame rate is.
I have no idea. I really have no idea. I expect that I will be a nerd. And that's about all I can say. I'm interested. I'm also highly involved in Occupy Wall Street. We just came out with a book there. And in my alternative banking group, I'm not going to say that I'll be necessarily working with Occupy in 5 years. I don't know if Occupy will exist in 5 years. But what it's done by being there is it has exposed me to this kind of activism and concern for systemic issues and concern for income inequality and political issues in our country. And I think the best thing I can say is that I wouldn't be surprised if I were talking about, if I were investigating using data, political issues, and trying to, you know, I'm no longer naive to think that just put a mathematical band-aid on a political problem and it's going to go away. So it's more like you have to think more politically than that. But I do think that doing data the right way, in an ethical way, is one side of it. The other side of that same idea is talking about when things are not being done well. And so I'm, to that end, I'm writing another book, believe it or not, which I'm hoping to finish. So maybe in 5 years it'll be finished, hopefully much sooner than that, about this concept of modeling in our society and the effects that it's having on people and income inequality and democracy.
It seems that in the way your career is progressing, you're getting much more and more into the communication side of things. It isn't just doing the work, but also communicating it.
That's right, absolutely.
Starting with your blog, but your blog is one major piece of that too.
Right.
But not everyone, I mean, a lot of people do blogs, not everyone attracts the feedback either. There are many blogs out there with no comments, with just quietly going along, but clearly you're doing more than that.
So. Yeah, and you know, I just got invited, a very kind invitation to go to a Swedish conference on beauty and mathematics. Which I'd be love to be able to go. I have to talk to my family, obviously. But, you know, the idea there is, you know, visualization. And it's something I would never have imagined mm-hmm. even 5 years ago, mm-hmm. which is why I'm so reticent to make like a prediction in 5 years hence. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, what are the basic qualities about me? I'm a nerd. I am a communicator, and I care about people. Mm-hmm. So who knows? But those things are probably going to still exist. And I'm very lucky. I'm very lucky to be living in this time and mm-hmm. be able to have the voice I have. I mean, my blog has been amazing. Mm-hmm. And without, you know, the internet, mm-hmm. it wouldn't have happened. Right. So you can thank my mom, by the way, because she was part of that. My mom was a BBN back in the day.
Ah.
She was like a super user on the BBN side of the internet.
Uh-huh.
I say that, like, she would interrupt me and say that she did not do that, but she did not build the internet. But, you know, it is amazing to me what kind of things have happened mm-hmm. just in my lifetime.
Right. And things are still changing.
Oh my God, yeah. The stuff that my kids are going to be able to do is pretty amazing.
Okay. And the new emphasis on things like big data and what you can extract for good or ill.
Right. So I'll tell you one thing. I won't lack for job opportunities mm-hmm. unless I become so abrasive mm-hmm. that no one wants to talk to me. Because
right.
as a data scientist who knows what they're talking about, it's mm-hmm. You're in demand mm-hmm. right now, and it's mm-hmm. not going to stop. I mean, mm-hmm. look, there's a wave of hype right
yeah.
now, so it's going to dip.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's going to dip too far for the likes of me
mm-hmm.
in the sense that I actually am mathematically, like, fundamentally sound. So
mm-hmm.
the people who actually know the difference between saying they understand algorithm and actually understanding an algorithm
mm-hmm.
are always going to have jobs,
mm-hmm.
and because there's always going to be data.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lot to mine.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question then becomes, like, is my generation of data scientists going to do it right? Or are they just going to do whatever they're told to do?
Right. Good. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. Okay.